Happy to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, did you know a cockroach has about the same amount of protein as beef? That's one of the things I learned when I read through the book, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. And we have a chance to visit with the two authors of that book. Cy Montgomery has been described as part scientist, part poet. Throughout her career as a journalist and author, she's written 20 books for both adults and children. Elizabeth Marshall Thomas is a best-selling author and anthropologist. She spent a lifetime observing other creatures and other cultures from her own backyard and all the way to the African savanna. Maybe you've eaten a bug, but maybe you've read Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. I hope you have, and I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at their new book, a collection of essays. Cy Montgomery, welcome.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
And Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, thank you as well.
Well, I am thrilled too.
Well, I tell you what, you both don't remember this, I've interviewed both of you individually.
I do remember.
Ah!
This is why we jumped on the chance to talk to you again.
Cy, I remember when we talked about The Good, Good Pig, The Extraordinary Life of Christopher Hogwood.
That's right, and he appears again briefly in Tamed and Untamed.
He does indeed. And Elizabeth, you and I talked about The Hidden Life of Dogs, your book from, was it about 2010?
About 10 years ago.
Yeah, about 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't remember the year, but it was a while.
It was a while back. Well, yeah. See, having talked to you both, I was really delighted to have the chance to talk to you again and delighted to see that you have this collection of essays. And most of them, I think, came from the column you co-wrote for the Boston Globe.
That's right. Most of them. Quite a few of the essays in the book are new, though.
Yeah, I understand that. Just thinking back to that time when you were writing several of these essays, how did you decide what to write about? Was it just what you happened to have experienced, or what, Elizabeth?
Well, that's a good question. That's a very good question for a long time. But I think what you do see things in life that strike you. I started to write about the dogs because I had been writing about different African people before that, and I went to Uganda and I went to Namibia and so forth, stayed for a long time with my kids who were little. Then my kids grew up enough so they had to go to school, and so I couldn't take, they weren't portable anymore, so I sort of was wondering what I was going to do. And then I thought, I was looking at a dog that we were taking care of for somebody else who was a husky. And he used to roam around the streets. There were no leash laws at the time. And he would roam around the streets, and I would wonder what he was doing. And I thought, well, why don't I find out what he's doing? You don't need a grant to do that. You need a pencil, a piece of paper, and a dog, and that's it. And so I did. And that was because it was so interesting. Then the thought of writing a book about it was, very, very demanding. I couldn't not write a book about the stuff I found. And so it went from then cats. Cats are equally interesting. And on it goes.
And on it goes. And I tell you, I like you have this book organized. Part one's animals and people. Part two, birds, dogs, and cats, wild animals, tiny animals, animal abilities. And each of these sections has marvelous essays that you have written. I was so touched so many times. I was thinking about, for example, you write about Cy, I think you wrote about animals as teachers and also as healers. And there's even a little part of that that deals with how even a snail helps someone.
Yes. Yes. This is so amazing. Animals have been teachers and healers for humankind for as long as our kind can remember across cultures. But I think our kind, our modern kind, sometimes forgets this. But happily, there's almost a genre now of people writing about animals that have helped them through difficult times. There's a whole bunch of wonderful books, and one of them is called The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. It's about a woman who was felled by some strange disease in her busy, healthy 30s. And her friend brought her a little terrarium with a snail in it. And she was so exhausted by this disease that all she could bring herself to do was to watch the snail. Well, that was a blessing, because once she could watch that snail, she saw that the snail was doing all these amazing behaviors, that the snail had volition, that the snail cared about things, that the snail made decisions, that the snail was moving around a lot. And so her disease, which was like a chronic fatigue problem, really gave her a window into the tiny life of this animal, and the animal rescued her.
That was just an amazing part. And there you cite many other examples of pets and animals as teachers and as healers. And I really enjoyed that. One of the things I really enjoy about the book is we go from one topic to the next topic to the next topic, and each one is a whole new story that I find fascinating. Liz, you write about a lot of things as well. You write about the death of a dog.
Well, yes, we've experienced that a number of times, and it doesn't get any easier. It doesn't get any easier for people either, if it's a person that you lose. But and I think many people who have had this experience feel as I do, which is that it's very difficult to get through. And you don't really get over it. You store it away like you do for the death of a person. I mean, you can't always be thinking about the death of a parent or a grandparent or whoever. You can't always have that top in your mind, or you wouldn't get on with your life. But, and it's the same with the dog. I find myself thinking of certain dogs quite a number who I've lost. And I think about them one at a time. I mean, I'd be thinking about this one or that one. And they're in my mind. They live in my heart, and they're in my mind very often. And when I'm driving or just doing some chore that doesn't take any thought, I think of them. Of course, I also think of the people that I've lost in my life, but the dogs are very much there.
They hold such an important part. Dogs or cats hold such an important part in our lives. I think about, on the cat side, I think about, I've had many more cats than I have dogs, frankly, over the years. And I think about the day Frosty died, our cat. And it's something, they're so close, and they provide such wonderful support.
Support.
It's so hard to lose them. But one thing I would say that might give people some solace is, at least with our pets, when they're suffering or they're about to experience suffering and there is no hope, we can essentially take that suffering away from them and onto ourselves. Because when you humanely euthanize somebody, what you're doing is sparing their suffering and taking it on yourself. So at least you know that they are just fine, and that makes your own suffering easy to bear. So many animals, I think, would take on our suffering in a nanosecond. I mean, there's so many stories of animals across the board who would sacrifice themselves to save their offspring, to save their person. And sometimes we can do this when we can step in to ease the suffering of an animal whose time has come.
Yeah. And just to go along with that, and dogs, there's an essay on dogs that are other-abled, I guess you read.
Oh, yes. Animals with disabilities.
Animals with that? I couldn't remember the title of the essay.
Well, it's got my Thurber in it. He's the star. Yes. My little guy, my puppy, well, he's 2 years old now. He's named Thurber because, like James Thurber, he's blind in one eye.
Yeah?
And being blind in one eye is no big deal. And he was born that way, and he certainly doesn't feel sorry for himself, and it doesn't interfere with anything. But, you know, it's so odd. Some people feel that if an animal has any kind of a disability, if they've lost a leg or an eye or whatever, oh, they'd be better off put down. Boy, is that wrong. You can see animals enjoying themselves with all kinds of disabilities. There's now carts that you can get for your dog if your dog's, and cats too, if their back legs no longer work. It's essentially a wheelchair for your animal. And people sometimes will say, oh, I don't want to be confined to a wheelchair. Well, a wheelchair doesn't confine. It liberates. And animals see that. Animals totally see that and seize the moment and live their lives with joy. And sometimes when we see an animal with a disability, I think it speaks to us deeply. One of Thurber's good friends, believe it or not, is named August, and she lives on our street and is the same age as he is, and she's also a one-eyed puppy. What were the chances of that?
Oh, boy.
And she lives with a therapist, psychiatric therapist. And not only do this person's clients love having the puppy around, but they also love that the puppy isn't perfect also, like them. And she says it just helps them to see somebody who isn't quote-unquote perfect, who's loving their life.
Oh, boy. We're talking today with Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. They've been writing for a long, long time, some wonderful books, and their latest is called Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind, a series of essays. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page. Larry Mueller here with Chris Molina on the Ideas Network. Talking with Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, authors of the New York Times bestselling book, Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. We learn about how animals tell time, what they dream about, even hear stories of animals who enjoy a casual drink, as a matter of fact. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And Cy, I want to go back to you for a minute or two, because in a couple of essays, the octopus comes into play.
Yes.
And I was reading, and I think it was the Great Pacific octopus, a single sucker can lift 30 pounds, and they have 1,600 of those suckers on them. And they're wonderful animals.
They are just amazing. I mean, the suckers alone. The first time I met a giant Pacific octopus, I met her glance. Her eye swiveled in the socket and looked at me. She turned color with emotion, and she slid over to me from her lair. And with the top of the tank open, her suckers came up, reaching for my arms. And, of course, I couldn't help but plunge my arms into the water with her. And soon, I was covered with those suckers. And let me tell you, it is an amazing feeling. It's like being hugged and kissed at the same time. But I did have a problem when I went home because I had to explain to my husband why I had all these hickeys.
And their feeling comes from those suckers, does it not?
They can not only feel you, but they can taste you. They can taste with all of their skin, including their eyelids, but most exquisitely in the suckers. So, you know, had a person been tasting me so early in our, you know, in our acquaintance, I would have been alarmed. But because it was a giant Pacific octopus, I felt just thrilled because here was somebody so unlike a human that you'd have to go to outer space or science fiction to find someone more unlike us. And yet, she was clearly as curious about me as I was about her. And that began a friendship with octopuses, with Athena and her successors, that lasts to this day. I am still friends with the octopuses at the New England Aquarium, even though giant Pacific octopuses only live 3 to 5 years. And so my heart gets broken again and again and again. But, boy, it's worth the heartbreak to know someone like that.
Well, and I just to add to that, I was intrigued when you talked about in one of the pieces about the fact that they're playful and they can play little tricks.
Yes.
You talk about one hiding a pail or something.
This was a riot. This was the second time I met Octavia, and I had gone in with some friends on a radio show, and they wanted to do a piece on how smart octopuses were. And I didn't know Octavia very well, but she was interacting with us. There were several of us. There were maybe 5 people all standing around the tank, and many of us actually had our hands in the tank. And we were playing with her and petting her and giving her fish and watching her change color and feeling her suction and touching her custard smooth skin and watching her eyes. And then all of a sudden we thought, you know, oh, let's give her another fish. And we look to find the bucket of fish, and she had stolen it right out from under us. We had never seen it happen, but she had. I mean, they are so great at multitasking, whereas, you know, in fact, a severed arm can go off and do stuff with an octopus. If somebody bites off your arm, it can go off and even hunt and theoretically catch prey. Of course, the arm isn't going to live very long because the 3 hearts are in the mantle of the animal, which is, you know, far away. But it's almost like each arm has its own brain. But they do seem to have a sense of humor. She didn't just want to steal the fish. She did not, in fact, eat the fish. She was grabbing the bucket. And they love to play with toys. They like the same toys we give our children. There's an octopus enrichment manual that has been made up for zoos and aquariums to keep your octopus from being bored. And it suggests you give them Mr. Potato Head and Legos to play with.
Oh, boy. Several people online to talk with you. Let's take some calls. Robin in Burlington, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry.
Yes.
Hi, it's Robin. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I just wanted to say that it touched me when we talked about animals with handicaps. We have a horse that over the years has gone blind. First started in one eye, and now it's in the other eye. And he has brought so much joy to our family, and especially my daughter, you know, and rode it for the school in Madison and just, you know, gave her this love of writing, which I think carried over academically and to who she is. But 2 years ago, I adopted a dog that nobody wanted. It was almost like, oh, you're so great. You adopted this dog. It's blind. It has no teeth. It's 10 years old. I will tell you, that dog is the best dog ever. And I just want people to, like, we got that pup from Lakeland Animal Shelter in Walworth County, which is a great organization. But that people, you know, should really look into that because they do not know their disabilities. All they know is love. Right.
Yeah.
And they are just, he has been a godsend to us because, you know, personal things, but always coming home.
I think we greatly overrate the problems of disabilities. We have a prejudice against disabilities, I would say, as a culture. My daughter
absolutely.
Was disabled. She was disabled at the age of 17. She was paralyzed. She's in her 50s now. She led a very productive, very interesting life, very productive. And she has two dogs, and one of her dogs is disabled, and he's leading a productive and interesting life. So it's very good to get this out, I think, because I think we have a very need, you know, put him out of her misery if she's paralyzed or blind or something.
No.
You know, that's not right, and it's ridiculous.
In my essay, I spoke to a friend of mine who's a veterinarian, and he actually was a veterinarian with the Tufts Wildlife Clinic, and he has argued many times with his colleagues in favor of saving an animal with a disability. Yeah. And you have to listen to Mark because he lost a leg to cancer. And he is living proof that just because you've got one body part that isn't there or doesn't work, that not only doesn't negate who you are, it may even give you greater compassion. It may even give you greater insight into others' lives. It may sharpen your other senses. It may make you a more compelling figure. So I'm so glad, Robin, that you called and offered that.
I think I'm going to give it to Christmas. it's a great book, and I really enjoy the program. So thank you so much.
Robin, thank you so much. Well, here's something different from Patricia in Wauwatosa. Hi, Patricia.
Hello there. Thank you. I'm so glad to be able to share this story, whom I have shared it with many, many people. I had a fish that lived to be 23. It was a goldfish. He was about 6-7 inches long. There was nothing in this 5-gallon tank except itself. And he was so incredibly alert and mindful of time. We were talking about time. And I fed him 3 times a day at 9 o'clock, noon, and 4 if I would be home. If I didn't feed him at exactly those times, he would bang on the edge of his aquarium. And then I think I would be in the kitchen, and I would, that's where I kept him, on a little chair. And I thought, oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, it must be noon. And it was. And I couldn't believe the intelligence of this animal and that he lived so, so long. And I think it was because I didn't put a thing in his aquarium, no weeds, no little gadgets and things. And it was just really quite amazing. And it was wonderful for the children that we'd come to visit. And I would tell them about as the age progressed to, you know, 23, and they were just really awed, and they all wanted to feed the fish if they were here at those times. And he died about 2 years ago, and I didn't have the heart to bury him, so I put him in his own water in a little plastic container, and he's still in the freezer. So he still gets a big laugh, and I say, well, you want to see the fish? Want to see Scooter?
Oh my goodness me.
That's wonderful. You know, there's a wonderful book that you would love called What a Fish Knows by Jonathan Balcom that was recently written. There's, as you know, people put goldfish down all the time and say they have a memory of like 30 seconds. That is such a lie. And there's another book called Your Inner Fish by Neil Shuman that points out that our bodies are basically, you know, the fish plan plus a bunch of time. Fish are really smart. What you have observed is now being chronicled by scientists. And these are long-lived, intelligent, thinking, feeling beings. And how lucky of you to get to know this fish for such a long time and let him educate your family and all your friends. Good on you.
That's true. When I would tell people the story about how intelligent it was, they would all say, "Ah, you've got to be kidding." And then when I did hear a scientist that was on not too long ago talking about the intelligence of fish, that we totally underestimate them. And so now I have a new one that's about 6 months old, and he's getting just as responsive, but he's in a much smaller little bowl. But eventually he'll have to go into a larger container. But anyway, I'm so glad to be able to share the story, and it's been a wonderful program. I'm such an animal lover, and thank you so much.
Give him something interesting to do. He might like to do some training with you. At the New England Aquarium, they've trained fish to do all kinds of entertaining things. It's like taking dance lessons or painting lessons or something, so that they don't get bored. You can have a blast with this little fish.
That sounds like fun, Patricia. Thank you so much for calling. I love that. So 23 years. I didn't realize a goldfish could live that long.
Yeah. You know why. I mean, people don't realize that these are little creatures who care about their lives, and their lives are just as precious to them as ours are to us. And so they don't often see to what an animal needs and look at them as like somebody that you get tired of them, you can flush it. Well, you certainly wouldn't do that with your grandmother or your in-laws or your husband. You shouldn't do it with your fish.
Exactly. Thank you again, Patricia, for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Such a broad range of animals that you talk about in the book. I was really interested. Was it Cy? Did you write about rats?
Oh, yes.
And
oh, yes. Rats are very smart. They're smart. They're ticklish. They're optimistic, and we think of them as nothing but vermin.
And the interesting thing I found in that piece, that essay, rats actually laugh when they play with each other.
Yes, and we did not know this because we can't hear it. But there are tons of voices that we don't hear in the animal kingdom. Liz Thomas worked with Katie Payne to discover that elephants can communicate across vast distances using infrasound. And dolphins can also use echolocation to find out various things. Well, rats' laughter is ultrasonic, so we don't hear it unless we use special instruments. But they do laugh, and they laugh under the same conditions that we do. They laugh when they're tickled.
and they laugh when they're playing.
Yes, yes.
And they're very smart.
Yeah, they really are. They know their names. They know quite a bit of English. They're real sweeties. And, you know, people think, oh, rats. But all around us, there's these animals with abilities like our own that we overlook, with abilities that exceed our own that we're unaware of. And part of what this book was trying to do was to point out just what a glorious place we're living in, surrounded by all of these rich, intricate lives.
Yeah, it's really much fun to read the book because you say, well, I wonder what little adventure we're going to go on in this next essay.
That was what it was like writing the column, you know, because we would decide, oh, what to do, what do we do this month, you know? And a lot of times, Liz and I would have just observed something really cool, and we would want to share that with readers, or we would draw on an insight that we wanted to elaborate on from our past. Or there's even an essay that Liz wrote one on hyraxes. We had gone together to Tanzania not last summer, but the summer before. And I'd also gone to Kenya, and I wrote about hyenas. So just everywhere we looked, there was inspiration to write.
Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Let's go to you next. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I wanted to tell a story of when we were burying our first dog, and we had to actually stop that process because this huge flock of cedar waxwings just hovered and flew and scattered all around us in an area where normally they are not. Like, there wasn't a mountain ash tree, there wasn't our currant bush there. And as we were standing and, you know, just watching them, we looked up ahead, and there was a blue heron that flew past us in the sky. And we were thinking that the blue heron might have been from where we lived before in Minneapolis, because we would often see that bird on walks. And then we just thought that the cedar waxwings were just all there to honor her spirit. So I just had to share that, because it was something that I've never seen since. And that's it.
What a wonderful story. Comment?
In a lot of cultures, birds and butterflies are symbols of, they signal that, you know, the veil between the living and the dead is thinner than we think.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Pat, for sharing that. You do write about birds a bit in the book as well, as a matter of fact.
There... Yes, Liz and I even took falconry lessons together, which was a blast.
And they are amazing, amazing birds, as you write about. Oh, man. Mm. I mentioned alcohol, and Luann in Green Bay has a story connected with alcohol and her dog, I believe. Luann?
Yes, it was our dog, and he was a miniature poodle, and he was sort of my dog, and he liked whatever I liked, including lemonade and stuff like that, that he hadn't read the book about dogs not liking citrus. But if I had a glass of red wine, he would be on my lap and ready to poke his nose into the wine, and he seemed to enjoy it. He didn't like champagne. The bubbles bothered his nose. But my husband got so upset that I was turning our dog into an alcoholic that I promised him that the next time we went in for a physical, I did ask the vet. I said, my dog likes to drink when I drink, and I drink, you know, a couple times a week. And the vet looked, I said, is this a bad thing? And the vet looked very seriously at me, and he said, well, is he neglecting his work or his relationship?
Ah!
And I said, great, no. And then he said, well, it's probably fine. So I just wanted to share that.
I love that response from the doctor.
We had a cat. People were sitting out in the yard having their evening glass of wine. We offered some to the cat, and the cat urinated on it. So, not all cats.
But you...
Well, remember tigers. If you're working with tigers, you're told, for it would seem obvious reasons, to avoid drinking wine. But there's another reason other than the obvious one, right, Liz?
I don't know the other one. I know.
Oh, you do.
Remember? The obvious one, I know.
You do. They will make flamin'.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you've seen this in house cats. But apparently tigers really are enraged by the smell of wine. And if you're working with tigers, it is not a good idea to be intoxicated in any way. But you shouldn't even have a glass, because there's something in, I think, white wine that their vomeronasal organ picks up and says something to them. And you have seen, right, Liz, you've seen cats stand over a goblet of wine and make flamen.
Yes, that's true, I have. And also, it was white wine that I was talking about.
Oh, wow.
Well, the next time I'm with a tiger, I will be sure not to have
any... don't drink, and don't show him a glass of wine.
For sure. Well, tigers reminded me of lions, and there's a fascinating piece in there, in your book, about a lion. I think, Liz, you wrote about it, a woman who had a close encounter with a lion for like 8 hours.
At least 8 hours, yes. Now, that was my friend Katie Payne, Catherine Payne, who was the person who discovered infrasound in elephants. And she was in Etosha Park in Namibia, in the tourist area, fenced off, because she had been hearing a lioness roaring in the bush nearby, and she was going to record it during the night. Okay, so she's there in her sleeping bag with her recording equipment ready, and a lion shows up, and he's a young but full-grown male lion. And there's a hole in the fence, a big hole in the fence that's patched only with chicken wire, but the lion sits right in front of it. He could have reached in through the fence and grabbed her. But She looked in at his face and looked into his eyes, and he looked into her eyes. And this is a really most amazing story, because it's very hard to get a cat, a house cat, to look into your eyes for more than just a flash, just a second. And most mammals don't like mutual staring. But Katie and the lion kept their eyes on each other's eyes. Katie didn't move at all. If she'd moved, she would have been done for. The lion would have got her. She didn't move for 8 or 9 hours. The moon rose. She saw the lion was drooling and looking at her and drooling, which is not encouraging.
No.
I mean, this is a really miraculous story, but that it absolutely happened is absolutely true. The morning came, the lion yawned, stretched, and got up. And he went into the bush behind them. And then Katie got up and was starting back to the camp, and she heard a scream and found that the lion had killed a kudu, which is a kind of antelope. So, obviously, he was hungry, and he was thinking of killing. I really feel bad about telling this story, because it's Katie's story, not mine. But I'm so taken with it that I asked her if I could write about it, and she said I could. She has written about it herself in her book called Silent Thunder, which is about elephants. So if you want the real best version of that story, you read that book. But ours does. It's such a good story, or it's such an interesting story, that I really couldn't help but ask her if I could use it.
Yeah, I found it fascinating that she looked in the eyes of this lion for 8 or 10 straight hours.
Yes, yes.
Without moving.
Without moving.
See,
I heard of another woman who had a similar experience. She was running in. I think it was Colorado, some western state. She was running for exercise out in the country. And a mountain lion, I mean, running away from a predator is a huge mistake. She didn't know she was running from a predator, but the predator thought she was. I mean, in the book I say, roll a tennis ball across the floor and see what your cat does.
Yeah.
You're the tennis ball, and, okay. And, the mountain lion jumped on her, but she, as she was falling, she turned over so that she was lying on her back, and her backpack was between them. She and the mountain lion looked into each other's eyes, and for quite a while. The mountain lion then got up and left.
Yeah.
There's something about people look into each other's eyes for various reasons. It's used for therapy. It's used for. It makes people feel closer, or it can tear them apart from each other. But it has a strong effect on a person to look into the eyes of another person for a long time. People meditate in this manner sometimes. So lions are not that different from people. They look different, and they sound different, and they seem different, but they're actually very much the same for many reasons.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising that this is so.
Well, I tell you what, Cy and Elizabeth, this has been a delightful 45 minutes, and I really have enjoyed reading your book, and I further enjoyed having a chance to talk with you. Obviously, there are so many other stories, and there's story about slugs, there's stories about mice, there's stories about deer, there's stories about wild dogs, wild feral cats, so many great stories, and I want to thank you for writing them and for presenting them to us in your book. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. To connect with your listeners.
Thank you. Cy Montgomery and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas. They are co-authors of the book Tamed and Untamed, Close Encounters of the Animal Kind, now in paperback. And Chelsea Green, the publishers, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at that book. Well, coming up, we are going to be visiting with you about a whole other topic. You know how we are on this program. We we go from extremes, from one extreme to another. And coming up next, we are going to talk with you about male infertility. We're also going to take a look at vasectomies, reversing them. We'll talk a little about cancer as well, men with cancer that affects their fertility. All that coming up next with our guest, Dr. Daniel Williams from the University of Wisconsin Department of Urology, here on the Ideas Network.